This is the eHealth Radio Network, your source for health advice on demand. And now your host, Eric Michaels.
Thanks once again for joining us here on the eHealth Radio Network. This is your host, Eric Michaels. eHealth Radio gives you the most current health information, news, and advice featuring some of the leading innovators in healthcare and wellness who are changing healthcare as we know it. For more eHealth Radio reports, we invite you to visit our main radio channel site at eHealthRadioNetwork.com. Today we're speaking to Dr. Leo Rosmarin, MD, a reconstructive hand and microvascular surgeon and author of the Jewish historical fiction novel Lone Soldier, an epic tale of romance, mistaken identity, war, and politics, all set against the backdrop of the tensions between the U.S. and Israel during the early 1970s. Dr. Rosmarin, a pleasure to have you with us today on eHealth Radio.
Thank you for having me.
And you're most welcome. Our pleasure. Looking forward to hearing from you today. So tell us about your novel, for starters, Lone Soldier, and what is it all about?
Fundamentally, it's a story of a socially and economically disadvantaged young man called Arik Meir from Los Angeles, and his coming of age as a lone soldier in the Israeli army during the early 1970s. Arik is the son of a severely disabled Israeli War of Independence veteran who, for some reason, which is not clear to the reader, was denied all care and compensation, despite, and also he was forced to live a life of abject poverty and medical complications for reasons that are not clear to even to him. Arik is a fellow who is brought up completely atheist and wants nothing to do with Judaism or the Jewish community and wasn't even educated as such. However, he is accidentally thrown into the civil rights struggle in Los Angeles during the late 1960s, and so doing discovers his own Jewishness, essentially with a fight with a white supremacist who is against African Americans and against Jews. And in fact, obviously, this is a very timely topic these days, unfortunately. Well, Arik ends up in a Jewish summer camp in Pennsylvania where he meets and falls in love with Dalia, who is the glamorous supermodel daughter of Israel's ambassador to the United States. Their relationship develops in a very, almost initially in a very conventional way until she finds out about Arik's past. I'm not going to divulge anything further with that. However, Arik is a superb athlete, basketball phenom, and he's offered a full basketball scholarship to play for UCLA at the time that they were national champions under John Wooden. However, and this would have given him financial security. However, because of the love of Dalia, because she was going back to Israel, and also the need to discover why he grew up in poverty, he turns it all down and goes to Israel to enlist in the Israeli army as a lone soldier. The love story between them turns catastrophic when it's set against external forces that are hell-bent on destroying them both for reasons that are not clear to them. However, these external forces tie their families together in ways that no one, even the reader, could have possibly imagined. Basically, Lone Soldier takes a hard look at prejudice in many of its forms and the corrosive effect it has on those who practice prejudice, but also the devastating effect on prejudice that has on its victims. It explores all forms of prejudice, racial, class, ethnic, and really it is a generalized look at prejudice in all of its forms. The premise of the book is that prejudice is a cancer that consumes the human soul. That's it in a nutshell. That's all I'm willing to divulge at this point.
As you have already grabbed my interest, I'm sure you have gotten the interest from the audience as well. Now, it says you wove together real-life historical facts with fiction. What was that process like for you? Get into some of those details.
This was really one of the most interesting parts of this thing because, you know, the fact is that, you know, you could write a historical fiction about Julius Caesar, and you could say whatever you want about him, the most ridiculous things. No one's going to get offended. Right, you know, unless you find somebody who's a descendant of his, which is highly unlikely. However, when you write a historical fiction that's set in the early 1970s, it is likely that either the people who you're writing about are alive or their families are alive. And many of these historical figures, which I interweave completely with my fictional characters in a very, very detailed way, many of these people are heroic. And if you get it wrong, there, you know, there's going to be all kinds of repercussions with that. And so you really, the critical thing with this kind of historical fiction is that you have to get the people right, not just their acts and their deeds, but you got to get their voice, because there are people alive that have heard them speak. And if you just say stuff, you're not going to, you know, that doesn't really record their voice. That's the problem. So I've had to, in part of my research, not only reading books about every single historical character, I read about and studied about 30 books, but I watched videos of them speaking, YouTube videos. I read books of letters of theirs that, you know, they wrote letters to other people that have been published, and I read their letters, and I had to get the sense. So even though the people that talk to my, you know, the historical people talk to my fictional people, the stuff that they say, they never said in real life. But at least when the reader sees this in the book, he will get, and if he knew that person, he'll say, yeah, he didn't say this, but it sounds like something he would have said. Then I was successful. So there's a tremendous amount of research that goes into, first of all, finding out exactly what they did, and then also try to get their voice. Now, when you write a historical fiction, the reader of this book will forgive the author for inaccuracies, quote unquote, in the account. You know, no one's going to say, well, I was there when, you know, in that, you know, episode that you wrote about, and it didn't happen that way. Nobody cares about that, because everybody knows it's a novel. It's not a nonfiction book. But they won't forgive mischaracterization of characters. So I always like to say that I really beat up on my fictional characters, but I never judge the historical characters. I leave them to the judgment of history and academics or what have you. But I'm not going to stand in judgment of the real people. And that's the trick of trying to weave in the fictional characters with the historical figures and make it seem, you know, really seamless in a sense.
Hey, that process and that approach certainly makes a lot of sense. Now, I understand you worked on the novel for 5 years. What kept you going that long, and what kept you motivated during that five-year stretch?
Well, this is going to sound a little crazy, but I couldn't stop writing it. Even if I wanted to write, you know, stop, I couldn't. I started off. It really goes to a different question, is how I, you know, started doing this to begin with. If somebody would have told me 7 years ago that I write a novel, I would say, I've never written a novel. What is the novel going to be about? And I don't even know how to write a novel, you know. And but all of a sudden, all at once, I started getting these people and characters in my head, and they started literally, I don't want to sound like I'm hearing voices, but they started talking to me, you know, and they started talking to me in terms of dialogue, and they started in my imagination. I started seeing all kinds of scenes and dialogue and about the personalities of the people that, you know, were talking to me. And what ended up happening was these people were banging around inside of my head for about 2 weeks. And I realized the only way to make this, you know, this cacophony in my head stop was to start writing this down. And I started typing for 2 weeks straight, from 8 o'clock at night till midnight, 5 days a week. And my wife came over and she says, What are you writing so much? Because I do write professional stuff, like for chapters or articles, but she's never seen me type with that kind of intensity. I said, I don't know what I'm typing. She goes, then why are you typing? I said, I don't know yet. And after about 4 or 5 days, she goes, you got to tell me what you're doing. I said, I think I'm writing a novel. She said, you don't know how to write a novel. I said, I know, I don't, but I can't stop writing. And that's kind of what kept me going. Once I kind of fell into this world, I couldn't get out. You know, it almost sounds crazy, but no matter what I did, all I could do was just keep going. And over time, The story sort of told itself. Now, that's not to say that everything came to me in chronological order. It came just as ideas. Sometimes I'd be in the operating room operating on somebody, and all of a sudden, as I'm working, all of a sudden some idea would pop into my head. You know, and I kind of hold that. Obviously, I wasn't going to do anything during the surgery, but, you know, I'd wait till I get home, and I would start writing it. And I call these things snippets. And I wrote about 35 to 40 snippets. Each one was about anywhere between 5 and 20 pages long. After about 2 years of this, I started looking at all these things, and I started to assemble them. I realized that I can kind of play with these things and kind of put them into some kind of chronological order. At that point, I made, like on a whiteboard, I made an outline, and I started hanging. You know, I say, okay, snippet number 12 goes here, snippet number 25 goes here, and I started to arrange them, and slowly but surely, it almost came together like a jigsaw puzzle. But obviously, these scenes had to be connected some way, and that already wasn't so hard to do. It took me about 3 months to connect it, but it just kept on, you know, these ideas kept on coming into my head, and I just couldn't, the only way to shake them out of my head was to put them down, and eventually just developed a life of its own. But there's one other thing. It's one thing to have the plot, but there's so many technical aspects. People who have read the book told me that you seem to be an expert in every field. Well, the fact is, I'm not an expert in every field except for maybe hand surgery. But the difference is, and this is critically important, you got to know what you don't know. So whatever I didn't know, I read books on it, and until I knew it. And once I read books, I found people in my practice, patients, who were kind enough to sit with me, and I interviewed them, and some people sat with me for 2 hours. It was just an absolutely incredible journey to do this. I mean, I've never served in the military, but I sat with people who are special forces. I don't play basketball, but I have a gentleman who grew up in the inner city and played basketball, you know, in the inner city. And he gave me, you know, the lowdown of what it was like to play basketball in the inner city in Los Angeles. I'm not a sailor, but I have another patient who is an America's Cup sailor. And it just goes on and on. I mean, there's a lot of martial arts there. I don't know anything about martial arts, but I read about it, and then I had some patients who were, you know, very, very high-level martial artists, and they read what I wrote, and they said, well, this is good, this is not good. And by the end of it, it actually seemed okay. And then I plugged all those technical things into the plot. So that was like another element to it.
And I'm sure at this point you've jazzed up the audience to read this book, no doubt about it. Today we are with Dr. Leo Rosemarin, MD, a reconstructive hand and microvascular surgeon and author of the Jewish historical fiction novel Lone Soldier here on eHealth Radio's Health News Channel, a part of the eHealth Radio Network. Now, besides being an author, Dr. Rosemarin, you're also an orthopedic surgeon. Tell us what made you interested in writing a far cry from surgery, isn't it?
Well, I'll tell you. Writing this book, I live a very high energy, high tension practice. I do about 15 surgeries a week. I see upwards of 110 patients a week, and that continued while I was writing. And a very busy family life. Writing this book, one of the things it did was it helped me de-stress from my busy work and home and community life. And what I was able to do was enter the world of my characters, and in fact, you're really taking my mind off my day job, if you will, and getting into this world helped me. Just like people sometimes they need to de-stress and they go watch TV, but when you're watching TV, you're watching what somebody else wrote. You're watching the story that somebody else wrote. That helps, you know. When you go watch TV, you get to, you know, kind of escapism. But this is escapism on steroids when you're actually creating the story. And that really, it made me a better surgeon, it made me a better dad, it made me a better community leader, in all different ways. It really, by really kind of letting me de-stress and decompress. The other interesting thing is that this book is set at a time when I made the transition between adolescence and adulthood, you know, and that's a really, you know, very difficult time for everybody, you know, because, you know, when you're a teenager, you don't even know what you're doing, and and 10 years later, you're an adult. That transition is very, very difficult, and it There are many unresolved issues that everybody has. You know, so some people just live with it. Some people go to the shrink, you know, to discuss it with them. What I chose to do is set my book during those exact years. And while none of the actual scenes in the book are scenes that happened to me, many of the issues that I raise in this book, I actually lived through, and it allowed me to kind of process, you know, narratives that have been floating around in my head for 30 or 40 years, and to look at them and kind of take it out of me, look at it from the outside, and then change it, if you will, by putting in my, you know, my adult fictional narrative, and then put it back in. So it's almost like taking a, you know, a piece out of a carburetor, you know, and then, you know, fixing it and then plunking it back into the carburetor, and also the car starts. That's kind of what it was like. And because of that, it really helped me. Now, to do this, and, you know, to write something like this, you really have to be careful not to let it interfere with home life. So what I used to do is, my family doesn't get started on Sunday till 9 a.m. I woke up at 5:30 in the morning. We go to the beach. They also woke up at 9 a.m. I woke up at 5:30 and I sat by the, you know, sat looking at the ocean at the sunrise, and I just wrote. It was like that. And then in the evening, you know, I do all my family stuff. I'd be done by about 9 o'clock with the kids, homework and whatever. And I just sat and wrote till midnight. Some days it was tiring sometimes, because I wouldn't get to sleep sometimes till about 12:30. Then I've got to get up at 6 again to start the day again. So that was hard sometimes, but I really tried to, you know, fit it in and not let it interfere with my my family and community and professional duties.
Well, it certainly is clear that you were passionate about this, and where there's passion, there is a will, and you certainly, not taking away from any exhaustion that you felt along the way, but you certainly made it happen, and hats off to you for that. What an example. And it certainly would portray into your level of expertise in the healthcare space as well. Lastly, any advice do you have, or what advice do you have for others who may be interested in using writing as an escape from a busy, stressful job? What advice do you have there?
Well, here's a couple of things. There's a couple of points. Number one, don't sit at the computer trying to write if you have nothing to say. During the entire 5.5 years that I was writing this, never once did I have writer's block. So you can't sit in front of a computer, in front of a blank screen, and say, all right, I'm going to write a novel. It's not going to happen. Unfortunately, you have to have it happen the way it happened to me, where you got something in your head that's driving you mad, and the only way to get it out is to write it. So that's number one. The other thing is that storylines come to you at random moments. So what happens is, sometimes you just jot down a little piece of, you know, something on a piece of paper, or, you know, on the phone, and even if it's not chronological, you can always assemble that later on. Always be prepared to listen to a lot of criticism from people, and be prepared to do the research, especially if you're trying to do a historical thing. And we already talked about incorporating the non-fictional aspects and interviewing experts. Also, be prepared to make frequent changes as more information comes in. And don't be stubborn about keeping something in when something better comes along, or if an editor comes and says, we're just going to chop out 10 pages. When my editor started looking at this, he literally at one point chopped out 10 pages out of my book, and then he said, okay, do you miss it? Does it do anything bad to the book? I said, wow, you just chopped out 10 pages of writing, and it was fine. Always take constructive criticism. And as I said before, you got to be disciplined to write the book so it doesn't interfere with your family and work life. But the key here is to be able to shift gears. That is the key. So you've got all the stuff that's going on in your head and around you during the day and everything. The key is to be able to have the discipline. If you're sitting down to write, just literally shut that out. You go into a quiet place, just like you close the door. You're also closing your head to everything else, and just let your mind flow into their world, into Arik and Dahlia's world. And once you do that, you find that the story kind of almost, not quite, but at least in the beginning, the story wrote itself. And then obviously there was a lot of stuff that had to go into it afterwards.
Dr. Rosemary, it certainly has been more than a pleasure to have had you today with us. And after spending 5 years on content, this book is certainly a must-read, no doubt, especially it being a Jewish historical fiction novel, The Lone Soldier. If folks wanted to get further information on this book online or make purchase, where could they best get all the details and make purchase?
If you go on Amazon, Lone Soldier appears, and you'll see it with my name, and you can buy it on Amazon soft cover, or you can get it on Kindle. And if you want to learn more about the book, I have a website called lonesoldierbook.com, and it'll give you a lot more information than we even discussed today. But it's on Amazon.
Well, that certainly works. Again, Dr. Rosemary, all the best. Thanks so much for joining us here today on eHealth Radio. Much appreciated.
Thank you very much for having me.
And it was more than our pleasure. We've been speaking with Dr. Leo Rosemarin, MD, a reconstructive hand and microvascular surgeon and author of the Jewish historical fiction novel Lone Soldier, an epic tale of romance, mistaken identity, war and politics, all set against the backdrop of the tensions between the U.S. and Israel during the early 1970s. And for further details, visit lonesoldierbook.com. And again, this has been your host, Eric Michaels, and we do thank you for your continued support of the eHealth Radio Network. Join us again soon for another episode that will help further expand your knowledge on those things that are important to your health and wellness. For more eHealth Radio reports, we invite you to visit our main radio channel site at eHealthRadioNetwork.com. And as always, we do thank you for tuning in.
Thanks for tuning in to the eHealth Radio Network. For more information or to subscribe to this podcast, visit eHealthRadioNetwork.com.